Hi there, and welcome back to the Hugo's There podcast. I'm your host, Seth Heasley, and I'm reading the Hugo winners one guest at a time. My guest for this episode is Emmanuel Dubois, and we are going to be discussing Connie Willis's two-volume winner of the 2011 Hugo Award for Best Novel, Blackout and All Clear. So, Emmanuel, thank you for joining me.
Bonjour, Seth. Thank you very much for having me.
Yes, it's a pleasure to have you back. You have previously been on podcasts with me on Take Me to Your Reader. Emmanuel brought his World War II knowledge to bear on our discussion of Slaughterhouse-Five, which was really cool.
Yes.
Why don't you tell us a little about yourself?
Yes. So as you can probably hear, I'm French. I mean, I was born in France and I arrived to Canada when I was about 9-10 years old. I love science as a kid, but I was not into science fiction. Because my family was not, simple as that. Mm-hmm. And then when I was about 11, friends of my dad's gave us a box, the VHS box of Star Wars. And that's, so I was 11 years old, 1997, and I watched Star Wars for the first time. And I had the same, it did the same effect on me as it did on kids in 1977, you know, it pretty mm-hmm. much opened my. And then I went to my local Blockbuster video, if you recall those, and I asked the guy basically show me more of that. And that's how it started. I started my sci-fi endeavor, if you will. So as a teenager, mostly through films and TV, then I discovered all the rest, you know, Star Trek, TNG on TV, the reruns, and all that stuff. And that would be a bit important in our discussion. As a literary genre, sci-fi is very snubbed in everything in France and here also. Basically, in a French-speaking environment, we have very little sci-fi. It's just not part of the curriculum. I mean, we have many other good authors. That's not a problem. Like, you will listen to, you will learn about, you know, Molière, Rabelais, Hugo, Dumas, all that stuff. But you won't read much sci-fi novel, even though, you know, Jules Verne is one of the fathers of the genre. Even, what's his name, Voltaire wrote a sci-fi short story. But it's just not part of what we learn. Then as in my late teens, I started studying history more. And I actually started a website on history. That's still on, but I sold it. But it was quite popular in like in 2003-04 when it reached its peak. It was around 2 million page views a month, which is, you know, not bad for a personal website. Mm-hmm. And then at the university, I studied history proper, got a master's thesis in history studying Franco-Soviet relationships during the rise of Nazi Germany, especially how the local French newspapers saw it, perceived it, analyzed it. So I read 4 French newspapers over a period of 2 years, which is a lot of newspapers to read. Mm-hmm. But it was quite interesting. And so for this part of my life, I was reading mostly history, but sci-fi came back when I was, I would say, 25, 26, through American comics, actually. I started discovering American comics because my knowledge of comics was mostly the French ones, you know, Tintin, stuff like that, Asterix. I don't know if you're familiar with that kind of stuff. So I started reading those, started reading superhero stuff, sci-fi stuff, and then I figured I should read some novels too. I've already read many novels, but not sci-fi novels, except maybe 1984 and Brave New World in school because I took an advanced English class. And a good friend of mine, Jérôme, salut Jérôme, if you're listening, told me, I knew he had read some when he was younger, told me, couple years back, you know, you should read Asimov and Dick and Bradbury, you know, to get you started. And I was hooked ever since. Mm-hmm. I've been reading many sci-fi books. And aside from that, for a living, I am a camera store manager here in Montreal, Canada. Camtech Photo, like a boutique. If you ever drop by in Montreal, I welcome you. We focus mostly on documentary and humanist photography, but we welcome every type of photography. It's a nice area to be in. I've been here for, I've been there for 11 years now. So, you know, time flies. So that's pretty much me.
So it'll come up in why this book, but what was your background in history one of the reasons that you chose this entry on the Hugo list?
Yeah, yes, definitely. I've studied history for, you know, over 15 years of my life, and World War II is my main focus. So when I saw that there was a novel I mean, we discussed it before when around the time we were doing this Solaris 5 thing. You mentioned it, and I figured it could be a very interesting read first and discussion with you too. And in preparation to that, because I knew Connie Willis by name, but I never read her work. I started reading Doomsday Book and then To Say Nothing of the Dog before reading these, just so I could get the whole universe, if you will.
Yeah. So let's go ahead and go into starting our non-spoilers. So do you want to kick off a kind of quick non-spoiler synopsis?
Sure. I actually wrote one. So time travel is possible, but it has rules. Only historians are allowed to go back in time to study events. One cannot be sent to a place or time where the presence might interfere with the course of history. It's a law, an unbreakable law. But when historians are sent back to World War II to study the Blitz, Dunkirk's evacuation, or the V1 attacks, these laws don't hold up as well as they should. Connie Willis takes us to a time travel train where the stations and the hours get mixed up and the return tickets might get cancelled. We'll have to find our way through that incredible journey together.
Nice. Yeah. Yeah, this is the third entry, really, of novels. Well, kind of the third and fourth. But when you read Blackout, you know, you get to the end of the book and it says, read the exciting conclusion in All Clear later this year.
Exactly.
Because they were published in the same year. It's really 1,100 pages of one book broken into two.
It's two volumes
of
one book.
I'd say there's a slight shift in All Clear that we'll get to maybe in spoilers.
Mm-hmm.
But the main difference here is that we spend much less time in Oxford in the future.
True.
We spend almost all the time in the historical period. And that's really fascinating. It's very different than Doomsday Book in particular, because that's kind of split evenly between the two.
Mm-hmm.
And To Say Nothing of the Dog, there's a lot of kind of travel through the net and back to the past. And there's more than one time period that they're in as well.
Yes.
So here, being so much just in the past, it's a lot of just kind of a historical novel and less science fiction, with science fiction kind of sprinkled in through the whole thing.
Exactly. Like in Doomsday Book, basically Willis is asking what would happen if somebody was sent to the wrong place. What happens more specifically to the Black Death during the Middle Ages. So we follow, I think it was Kivrin's adventures in Mr. Dunworthy's efforts to retrieve her. So we go back and forth between the Middle Ages and 2060. And they have this epidemic in 2060, which, you know, is a good timing. Whereas in To Say Nothing of the Dog, she asks, could we bring something back from the past? And what would happen if that were done? And she's starting to poke holes in her own rule book and To Say Nothing of the Dog, as not one normally can't bring anything back. And the net, I don't want to spoil yet, but the mechanism they use to travel through time normally prevents that from happening. Mm-hmm. But when somebody does it, we start an adventure, and quite a funny one. To Say Nothing of the Dog, it's extremely funny. In Blackout All Clear, she keeps in this route, but she goes a lot deeper. It has a seriousness of Doomsday Book, some of the humor element of To Say Nothing of the Dog, not on the same level, but still, you can see she grew as a writer writing those, in my opinion. But it's a lot bigger in scale. It encompasses, I think, four stories in the past. Plus, you still have the story in 2060, even though it's smaller. And she manages to do it in a cohesive, in fascinating, in clever narrative, which is, you know, quite something. Plus, the very deep research she probably did on World War II, which we'll talk later about. But she clearly did her homework.
Yeah. Yeah, this is one of those ones that I was kind of shifting between the Audible version and Kindle version. You know, whenever I had time to sit down, I would read. And then, you know, if I'd drive someplace, I would listen to it. Or if I was mowing the lawn or something, just to help me get through, because it's quite long.
It is.
But on the Audible version, I can't remember if it was afterward or as a prelude, Connie Willis actually talked about how her husband had found a bunch of people who had lived through the Blitz and you know, nurses and other people, and set it up so that she could basically interview them for hours. And she based a lot of this book on their recollections, which was really, really cool. Just in terms of overall thoughts on this one, I loved it. I really, really loved it. All of it. It's not really a surprise because I loved to Say Nothing of the Dog. I loved Doomsday Book. I'd take as many of these books as she'd write. I'm curious if she's planning to go back to it, because in this book, there are some things that we can get to in spoilers that I feel like maybe she won't. But yeah.
Me, I did enjoy it a lot. I do have to say that my favorite book of the series is still Doomsday Book. Okay. I just like the rhythm of it more. Mm-hmm. But I acknowledge that as an oeuvre, this one is probably the major one. You know, it's yeah. So much deeper and more complex, and it's a very, you know, enjoyable and read, even though it's long. You know, I never found it. I do find that like the last maybe quarter of the first book and first quarter of the second book are a bit sluggish at time. But because we'll talk about it in spoilers, there's a reason for that. But I've read some reviews about the book actually, and some people found it to be very repetitive. I don't agree that it's very repetitive. It is at some time. But one, there is a reason for it. We'll discuss it in a couple of minutes. Yeah. And two, I still find that Willis does it quite well. She handles our characters and sets very, very well.
Yeah. In terms of comps for this book, I mean, it's sort of the same list of comps you would normally have for any of the Oxford time travel things, Quantum Leap, the old show Voyager, the short-lived show Journeyman, where you have time travelers who are maybe trying to fix something before they can move on. It's more apropos of this book, because usually they're not trying to fix anything. They're just trying to stay out of the way. But in this one, I don't think it's too much of a spoiler to say that you have three historians who go back to the timeline of the Blitz, trying to study particular things. Things go kind of badly, and they all find themselves thinking that they might have changed something. And since the net won't open back up, this is, you know, that's what they think. They think we've broken time.
Exactly.
And that's why it won't open back. And that's, it's spoilers, but it's spoiler light. Because the rest of the book then is them considering that, them getting more information along the line, and also trying to find each other.
Yeah.
To figure out how to get back.
Yeah. And to me, this book, the main theme of the book, because all these are like the mechanics of it, but the main theme of the book, in my opinion, is the good old fashioned idea of what is preordain and what is free will.
Right.
Which is a very classic theme in literature in general, but in sci-fi in particular. For a cinematic equivalent, think of the Matrix. You know, it's a whole different angle, but it's the same central idea. The whole story is based around free will, what it means for us as human beings, and it's a very central theme, I think, in this book. And the mini visits to churches and cathedrals do reinforce that aspect of the story. I was raised Catholic, so I'm a bit familiar with that stuff. You could ask this question: am I in control of my destiny, or am I just a cog in a chaotic system? Is everything decided by God or some other entity? You know, these are questions that have fascinated people for ages. You know, and I do believe that sci-fi is the best genre to explore these ideas, because you can put your characters in a kind of a parallel universe that allows you to ask these questions in a way that they're not, you know, silly or anything. In a standard novel, you cannot question the fact that your character has free will. It would not make sense. Here you can, where they're time traveling or connected to through a computer with tubes and stuff in their limbs.
Yeah. I think we should just go right over into spoilers. What do you think?
Agreed. Yeah, so yeah.
Let's talk about that criticism that the book is repetitive in places. I do want to say that it might be blasphemy to say that I could see someone doing a skillful abridgment of this story and cutting out some of the incidences. But the problem with that is that repetitive nature, that kind of rats or mouse on a wheel thing that happens in the book, gets you into the mindset of the people who are panicking that they may be stuck here.
Exactly.
Especially Polly, who, you know, major spoiler for her is you have this random sections of the book that you'll see set in 1945 toward the end of the war.
Which is a nurse, yeah.
With this character named Mary, right? Mm. And I did not pick up on the fact that Mary was Polly.
It took me a long time, too.
Until it was basically revealed in All Clear.
Yeah.
And so she has what they call a deadline, right? Mm-hmm. Where you can't be in two places at the same time. And so they know that by VE Day and before that, because she came quite a bit in advance, she has to get back or she will probably die.
Yeah, she came in 44 during the V1 and V2 attacks.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's really interesting, and it lends to the urgency of the book. And then you have a character apparently killed off, and then the theorizing about, well, it's the timeline, you know, is the net killing us?
Yeah. And I like, she uses that to put you in their shoes. Like, let's say you're stuck in England in 1940 during the Blitz. You're going to ask yourself the same questions again and again and again. You're stuck there. You're stuck pretty much in the worst period you could be in England, except for the Black Death. And of course, you're going to overthink about it, you know, especially these guys who think they could change history for the worse. They could make Germany win the war. That's what they fear, that one action they're doing could have a ripple effect that would affect the whole course of the war, which, you know, historically doesn't hold up, but in their minds are in this universe could work. You know, it could have this huge effect. We're discussing spoiler, like, for example, the character of Michael, which should have been sent to, I think, to Pearl Harbor, and he has an American accent because of that. He has implants. Is sent to Dover to cover the Dunkirk evacuation.
Right.
As an American journalist, he is, through various events, he's actually sent to Dunkirk on a barely seaworthy boat, the Lady Jane, which we find again at the end of the All Clear called the Mademoiselle Jeannette. It's the same thing in French.
Yes, I didn't pick that one up either until right when Michael realized it.
So he goes to Dunkirk, saves soldiers, and one guy thanks him for saving his life. And then he realized, my God, what have I done? I should never have saved those soldiers, you know, because I could, maybe this act will have huge consequences. Maybe this soldier will go back to war where he should have been dead. Maybe we'll kill an important, I don't know, German figure, which, you know, will trigger some. So during a good chunk of the books, they are worried that they could have damaged history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think doesn't it end up that one of the people he saved went back and saved another 500 people or 300?
Yeah, exactly, something like that.
Yeah, and that really causes him to
panic. Exactly.
Let's run down the characters. We have Michael, who, like you said, he's trying to study heroes of World War II, and he was going to go to Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. But what he doesn't know is that Mr. Dunworthy has started realizing there's something wrong, and so he wants to not do any more out of chronology drops.
Yeah.
And so since Dunkirk is before Pearl Harbor, he sends him to Dunkirk. And of course, the mechanism that the net has for avoiding conflicts, avoiding paradoxes, is slippage, either in time or space. And it turns out for him, it's both. And he ends up in Saltram-on-Sea and has to find his way to Dover. And then, like you said, ends up on this extremely unseaworthy vessel with the hilarious commander.
Yeah, he's so funny.
I told you I listened to the audio and read the book, and the audiobook narrator is absolutely fantastic. And she did a voice for him that as soon as we met him again later on, when after it had been named the Mademoiselle Jeannette, as soon as that character started talking, I went, "Oh, it's the commander."
There you go.
Which was really cool. And there was one other time where the audiobook narrator spoiled a twist for me, and we'll talk about that later.
Okay.
But so you have Michael, who's trying to study heroes, ends up accidentally going to Dunkirk and being involved in the evacuation, getting himself injured, and kind of becoming a hero himself.
Yeah.
Which he's uncomfortable with. And then you have Merope, who, since she doesn't have a name that is a contemporary name, she goes by Eileen.
Yes.
And she was studying the evacuee children, is that right?
Yes. So she sent in 1939 to a house in the country where they sent kids from London at the beginning of the war, which happened, you know, when the war broke off, major British cities decided to evacuate the children because they feared of the German bombardments, bombings. Right. Funny thing, if you will, they started bringing the kids back just before the Blitz started.
Yeah, I was not familiar with the term the phony war.
Yes, so the phony war is basically the period from September 1929 to May 1940, which is basically France and Britain have declared war to Germany. But they're doing nothing because Germany has invaded Poland September 1939. So French and England declare war, but then they just basically demobilize and they wait because if you allow me a small parenthesis, you're in 1929, you're 20 years after World War One, so it's very fresh for these people.
Yeah,
and probably the people that suffer the most, you know, in percentage of population is the French. The French had over, you know, 1.2 million deaths for a country of 36 million people. That's huge. You know, that's big chunk of the population, mostly men from 20 to 30 years old. And destruction and many, you know, wounded people and traumatized and all that stuff. So basically the idea of a new war with Germany is very hard to take. So when they start that war, they basically don't want to wage war. They want to intimidate Germany so that it, you know, goes out of Poland, says sorry, and, you know, we go back to where we started. And this does not happen. You don't play chicken with Adolf Hitler. That's what they tried, basically. And also they thought that they had a perfect defense system in France called the Ligne Maginot, which was a series of fortifications. Anyway, May 1940, Germany attacks, and in six weeks, France is defeated. And we're talking about, you know, being in the mindset of these people. You have to imagine yourself in 1940 in England, learning that France has been defeated by Germany in 6 weeks. To you, it's like learning that South America was put together and invaded the U.S. and defeated the U.S. Army. It's about the same scale because at the time, the French army is the biggest land army in the world. It's considered to be the best army, better than Germany, better than anybody else. And there's, you know, they waged war for 4 years, 1914 to 1918, and they actually won the war with England and, you know, and America. So to them, it's a huge shock. For Britain, they just lost their big gun. The big gun was France. It was not Britain. Britain had the Navy. But as far as land army goes, it was the French. I think the French had 85 divisions, whereas the British had maybe 10. And the German have about 90 in terms of sheer numbers. So in the summer 1940, if you're British, it's quite gloomy. You know, your main ally has been defeated in record time. Even the Germans could not believe it. I mean, I've studied German documents of the time, even the German generals will, when they have to attack France, they're scared to death to attack France because they fear the French army. So when their tactics and strategy actually, you know, wins, they're flabbergasted. They're like, okay, we won. That's strange that we won so easily anyway. Even though the French fought like hell, I mean, they lost 60,000 men in 6 weeks. That's, you know, that's hard fighting. You still, in, let's say, in June 1940, you're in England and you're alone against this very strong enemy who has just defeated your big gun, and you have to hold on, to hold the line, like, you know, like we say. And I can imagine the mindset of these people to be very negative. And to come back to what I was saying earlier, since there were no bombings of England or almost no bombings during 1939 to this period of summer 1940, those evacuated kids that were in the country were sent back to the cities because they said, okay, the Germans are not bombing us, so why bother? And then the bombing started.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm really stoked to have you on to provide that kind of background to it. So Eileen, when she's working with the evacuated children, she, of course, is hounded constantly by these two hellions, Alf and Binny.
Yes.
what was their last name? Bin?
The Hobdins.
Hodbin, that's right.
Hodbin,
yeah. And they're hilarious.
Yes.
I just absolutely love them. And their Binny comes down, well, they end up with an outbreak of the measles. Mm-hmm. And Eileen believes that she may have saved Binny's life because she gives her aspirin to bring her kid to keep her fever down. And so she fears that that could be what she changed, right? She saved mm-hmm. the life of one little girl. Who knows, you know, what happens with that. So then the other person we have is Polly, who, like I mentioned, is in two different places. In toward the end of the war, she's an ambulance driver.
Mm-hmm.
But during the Blitz, she's working in a shop. And the benefit of her working in the shop is she's prepared for that, and she has been given, you know, subliminal programming that tells her where the bombings happened,
yeah.
right? So she can always make sure she's in a safe shop that was never hit. She's in a safe flat that was never hit.
But then she has a limit.
Yeah, but she does have a limit to how far that knowledge goes.
She knows until, I think, December 1940 or January, something like that. After that, she doesn't know all the details.
Right. Yeah, and so she knows that if they get past the date that where she knows where the bombings are, then they could very easily be killed.
Exactly. And just to put you in perspective, the Blitz of England started in September 1940. And stop in May 1941, more or less. And you have about 40,000 dead on the British side. And yeah. over, I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of buildings destroyed. So this is serious stuff. You know, you don't want to be there.
No, it's no joke. What did Polly, I think Polly thinks that one of the shop girls that she worked with made a decision differently somehow. And ended up a nurse.
Her colleague, yes, because I don't recall the name of the colleague, but yeah, she
Marjorie?
Maybe Marjorie, yes. I think it's a name like that. And yes, he discussed with her doing your bit for the war effort and da-da-da, and at some point, I'm going to be a nurse. And I think she finds herself in a place that is bombed, where she was not supposed to be or something like that, wasn't she?
Yeah. So all of them have this thing that they think they might have done to break time.
Exactly.
And that's where, you know, you have a lot of instances of the kind of litany, the for want of a nail, the shoe was lost, for loss of a shoe, the horse was lost. And lots of thinking about that.
And they're basically trying to guess what are repercussions of their acts, because for all of them, the net to go back home stops working. That's a common element. And that's when they realize that, that's when they start to say, okay, they try to find each other, which takes them some time. It's not easy at first.
Yeah, they definitely cross paths several times, where I think Polly goes north to the country to try to find Eileen. At the same time, Eileen comes to London to try and find Polly. Because if your drop isn't working, you think, well, Polly's here at the same time. Maybe hers is working. I'll go to that one. Because, like, I think Mike tries to go to his drop, and there's like a anti-aircraft gun or a sea gun or something
exactly.
right there. And so he realizes it'll never open because there's people there.
Exactly.
One fun thing is that, you know, anytime you're a historian, right, you have to have your dossier in place. You have to have your character. And so, like, you also have to do a little bit of BSing when you're talking to people. Oh, yes, I came from Oxford. Oh, well, did you know Jimmy
or
whatever? You know, did you know someone who was at that post there that I know? And it happens, I don't know, 8 or 9 times, it seems like, where right when somebody is about to ask the question that they can't answer, they get interrupted by someone else.
Yes, saved by the dong. And one place that I find very funny is when Michael that goes to Bletchley Park, mm-hmm. which was the center for British intelligence in World War II, right. And he's scared stiff that he might encounter someone or have a discussion with someone he should not have, and it would have huge repercussion on the war effort. Because here you have this hub of British intelligence, you have Alan Turing working there,
right.
You know, on Enigma. And it's true that if something happens there, it could have a huge impact on the course of the war. So he's scared to death. In that regard, he has this bicycle accident with Alan Turing. Alan Turing runs into him, falls down, and goes back again. Then you have the girls that are they have a name. These were the basically mathematicians, women that were working the numbers that the Turing and his team were churning out of their computers or whatever. And not computers, but and they pick him up and they say, "Oh, it's Alan. He does that all the time." I'm surprised he's not dead already, you know. And he's like, "I just hit Alan Turing, my God."
Right. Well, yeah, because then he thinks, well, what if Alan Turing was following a train of thought while he was on his bicycle?
Exactly.
And now I knocked him off of that. And there was a key insight there that now he never gets back to.
Exactly. And the funny thing, you mentioned Mr. Dunworthy at the beginning of the discussion. He's basically the headmaster of the historians. He's the one that manages who goes where and when. And at the beginning of the book is he's sending people to other places they were supposed to go, and they rush everything. They have to go now, you know, they rush everything.
Yeah.
Nobody's perfectly prepared. And you realize something's off. There is something wrong. But what is wrong is not what he thought was wrong. We realize that in all clear. He thought that they as you said, they had to go in a certain way to prevent issues, but we realize that in the end, it's not what's happening. It's that they're going back to time. His part of history.
Yeah, that's when the insight kind of flips on its head. That it's not that time is correcting because of their actions. It's using their actions to correct itself.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's when I think Eileen eventually realizes that Alf and Binny might have been an agent of time correcting things all along the point, you know, delaying Eileen at some point, delaying a car from going someplace. And that very much reminded me of Bellwether, another Connie Willis book, where there's a character there that seems to be an agent of chaos. And you realize, oh, but she's kind of causing everything to happen that needed to happen.
Okay.
There's also, and I maybe you could talk about this as a historian, because at some point, Mike disappears from the timeline where he, not from the timeline, but he is apparently killed.
Yeah, he fakes his death.
And yeah, he fakes his death. And, but this is another thing, kind of like you had Polly and Mary, who are the same person, but on different drops. So you have Michael and I can't remember what his name was on the other, further along after he had faked his death. I can't remember what name he was going with because his language and dialect implant had stopped working. So he sounded English again.
There you go.
But he was working on some of the preparations for D-Day, right? With inflatable tanks and stuff, staging them.
Operation Fortitude.
Yes. To make it look like the attack was going to come at Calais and instead of Normandy. And, going around trying to loudly talk about the invasion that's definitely going to be happen on this date in Calais.
Yeah.
Just to try and fool the Germans. And that's another thing where it's, they don't call it a tipping point. I can't remember what they call it, a critical event or something.
I think it's critical event or something like that, yeah.
Yeah. Where they, no one's ever been able to travel in time to particular times and spaces because it was so much could have turned on, in one of many directions that in a chaotic system, even the tiniest little nudge could have caused something different to happen. The Germans don't stop the, I can't remember what the one thing was.
He fears that the Germans won't buy the story. And I recall he's scared also when he meets General Patton. Because General Patton was the man in charge of army, which infuriated him at the time, because Patton was basically the American general that you send to enforce the enemy line. He's the one that you send to go through the enemy's army. So putting him in charge of that fake army was making this fake army very believable to the Germans. Mm-hmm. And at one point, I think they have an event, some kind of social event, and he's there. And he sees Patton. Mm-hmm. I think he says something to him or whatever. And he's like, he's trembling in his shoes. Because as you say, if he does something wrong or during the placement of fake tanks in fields and stuff where he has to fight a bull at some point, he also fears that he will do something wrong and a German airplane will see him and then they will know these are fake and then it will tell Germany.
See a deflated tank. Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, there was another point that I can't remember if it just kind of in terms of the actual history of the war, where the Battle of Britain was happening and it was getting down to just a few planes left for Britain. And then Hitler changed tactics. And so there's the worry that, okay, if we don't pull this off, then he's just going to finish off the British Air Force and then invade.
Yes, it is mentioned. This is actually historically quite close to the truth. The Battle of Britain is just before the Blitz, and the idea of the Battle of Britain is to destroy the RAF. It's an air battle with fighters. So the German Messerschmitts versus the British Spitfires, basically. And it's a very tough battle, and the British have less resources than the Germans. So they can't afford to lose as many planes and men as the Germans. Right. And German intelligence had actually quite accurate numbers of about how many planes the British had, how many they could make. And they say, okay, if we destroy that many planes per week, either on the ground or in the air, we should be fine after that many weeks of fighting. You know, that's basic calculus. And at some point, two things happen. First, they don't understand why, but there are still British planes in the air, even though they've destroyed the numbers they wanted to destroy. The answer to that is Canada. We are sending parts and planes and engines to Britain by the boatload. And Germans had zero spies in Canada. So they don't know exactly. And because for to them, Canada is basically fields of corn somewhere in North America. They don't know that overnight, Canada is going to be the main industrial center for the British Empire. even though it's not a British colony anymore, but, you know, we made these huge factories to produce planes and stuff pretty much overnight. And to this day, Canada is a big, you know, in aeronautics, an important country. And so we're sending all that stuff to help the British. And so that's one part of the equation. The other part is that one day there is a bombing by the Germans. They want to bomb some factory in England and they miss and they bomb London, I think. And they kill civilians. But it was not deliberated. It was an accident. Because at the time, they were trying to bomb factories and, you know, industrial centers and stuff. When this happens, Churchill, being the smart guy he is, says, okay, let's bomb Berlin. Not because he wants to kill German civilians, wants to, if we forbid the expression, forgive the expression, he wants to piss them off. And he succeeds. Because Hitler said, there's never going to be a bomb in Berlin. And then, you know, they strike Berlin, kill some German, and now they change strategy. Okay, let's bomb England into submission. So it's gradual. They still bomb factories and industrial centers and stuff, but then it switches progressively to the Blitz, which is trying to destroy Britain's morale by bombing them every day and then every night. And to give you an idea, when they start this in September 1940, they bomb them every single night and day until November. So 2 months of everyday bombing. And these are waves of 200 to 300 bombers dropping bombs at anywhere between 50 kilograms to a ton. So it's a very heavy campaign. But the thing is, many civilians died during these raids, but Churchill achieved his goal. He saved the RAF because since not all Germany's forces are focused on destroying basically the enemy's military power, they're trying to destroy its morale. They fail. They because it's the British were not did not waver. They stayed strong, and instead of being, you know, scared, they rebelled against that. How come do the bombers is? And the Germans did the same. You know, if you flash to 1945, Germany is in ruins. It's completely destroyed. The Allies have annihilated the country. And morale in Germany started to waver in like March 1945. And then it did not collapse. It started to, you know, move a bit, but it did not collapse. And Germany was hit 20 times as hard as England. So it's very hard to break a people's spirit, even with bombs. As you know, the Americans tried the same thing in Vietnam, and you saw the result, you know.
Right. Yeah. Well, and for more talk of the bombings in Germany, I will refer the listener to our episode on Slaughterhouse-Five and talking about Dresden.
Yeah. True.
Yeah. There's a kind of a nasty study that I remember that was done one time with a mouse that was swimming in a bucket of water. that it would last, you know, that they tried it more than once. They put the mouse in there, it would swim for a certain amount of time, and then after a certain point, it would just give up and drown. Mm-hmm. But they realized it was a pretty consistent time that the mouse would give up. And so then the change was, right at that moment, lift the mouse out of the water and then drop it back in. And then the mouse would pretty much keep swimming indefinitely because it knows rescue is possible. And that, I think, it's gross to do that kind of study if you're actually letting mice drown, by the way. Yes. In the context of this story, right, you have the British people getting bombed every night, no end in sight to it. I have no idea how they persevered. Where, like, Polly and Eileen, they have the little bits of information about, okay, this station never gets hit. So if we go to this shelter every night, we'll survive. It just makes me admire the resolve of the British people during the Blitz, because they didn't know when it was going to end or if it was going to end.
That's true. And that's also a credit to Connie Willis' skill as a writer, because she does, she puts you in the shoes of these people, and she is very good to show you what the character live and feel. And we get that feeling from the British people that, as you say, they're being bombed every night. They don't know that the war is going to end on May 8, 1949, 1945. Yeah. They don't know that.
Yeah.
They don't know that the Americans are going to be involved in the war directly. Probable is yet to happen. So they're alone. As I said, they're alone and their main ally has been defeated. So everything looks very bad for them. And yet, they have this resolve, which, you know, is to their credit and honor, because, you know, I guess they were hope. There was hope that they could win in the end, that Germany would make a mistake, and they did that mistake. It's called invading the USSR, which is never a good idea. ask, you know, Napoleon or the King of Norway centuries before. Everybody that tries that fails. And to go back to Connie Willis, I do find that she's very good at putting you in her character's shoes. Right off the bat, she doesn't have to dwell into long descriptions of who they are, what they are. You get very fast a feeling of what they're doing and why. She doesn't dwell on description either for characters of the sets. She trusts your brain to do the rest, which is, you know, not an easy balance to strike. And she does that over and over in that book. For example, the details of the Blitz, how the people live, how they interact in those bunkers, in the houses, in the shops. She doesn't over-describe the place. You know, she tells you basically it looks like this. It's a tube station. Okay, I don't have to tell you what a tube station looks like. You can imagine it yourself. It's a hole in the ground with a train. Her thoroughness is more in the small details in the narrative, like the way people speak and behave and just how life worked in that era. Mm-hmm. She does that very well. It's very cinematic to me. I mean, I could see the scenes reading the book. I could imagine that in a movie or a TV series very easily, which is to me the mark of a very good writer, you know, one who writes with intelligence. And that's true of the whole series, by the way, of the Oxford Time Travel. But here she turned up to 11, you know.
Yeah. And particularly for me, the parts with Polly and the acting troupe, you know, entertaining everybody in the tube stations.
Sir Godfrey.
Yeah. You know, here in Doomsday Book, you don't really have any kind of a romance at all. Here, there's little hints where, you know that Eileen and the vicar care for each other. And then Sir Godfrey is definitely smitten with Polly.
Yeah.
And she is attracted to him as well.
Yes.
but it's not, you know, it doesn't bang you over the head with it. It's not a romance novel in any way. No. There's also Colin, of course, who is taken with Polly, and his idea is he wants to do some time travel where he spends a lot of time on an assignment and then comes back to, you know, essentially the same moment he left so that he can age up a little bit and be old enough for
exactly. Colin. That's funny. And he actually does, because he looks for them so long that he ages. And I love the part in the book where he meets Binny.
Yes.
An old Binny in 1995, I think. Like it says the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II, which is basically the... just parenthesis, the year where I got interested in World War II. I was in France in 1945, 1995, and where they had the celebration stuff. Anyway, and he meets her at this reunion of survivors of the Blitz, and she ends up telling him, Eileen stayed and took care of me and half is a judge, I think.
It was nice when she said he's at the courthouse.
He's at the courthouse. Okay, was it done now? No, he's a judge. Okay. And it's not said directly, but it's very implied that Colin is actually the grandson of Eileen.
Yeah, I think so. And I liked that...
she calls him my dear boy.
Binny keeps changing her name, right? Because her name is just a nickname. Their last name is Hodbin, and so she goes by Binny. And so I can't remember all the names she goes through, but there must be a dozen of them. And so then when he finally meets her and her name is Eileen, you know, we've already established that she's somebody who wanted a different name. And this is another case where I was listening to this part, and as soon as that character came up and spoke, I said, well, she doesn't have the same accent as Eileen. Her accent is closer to Binny's accent. Oh. And so I picked it up from the audiobook more than I would have from the book itself.
Yeah, in the actual book, it takes like a chapter or two to figure that out.
Yeah, so that was a neat reveal.
Yes. All the reveals, I would say, in All Clear, because basically all we're talking about here, all the reveals happen in All Clear, so in the second book, and I would say in the second half of the second book. So the first book is basically a big setup, just like Dune Part 1. and the second book is basically everything rolls. And it's, I like also when Dunworthy comes back into play. Way he comes back in December 1940 and he freaks out because it's not exactly what it should be. And also, I didn't know that, but there's a character, you know, they're looking for another historian who is in the fire brigade.
Right.
They're looking for him. And I didn't know that at the time, but I've read that this guy is a character from Connie Willis' short story, Firewatch. Exactly. I didn't know that.
Yeah. I also like that you get right at the end of Doomsday, not Doomsday Book, Blackout. You know, they've kind of all found each other finally, right? Mm-hmm. And that's kind of setting up for the next book. But then right at the end, you have this random historian who comes through and runs into somebody and she drops all her parcels. And you find out way, way at the end of All Clear that it was Dunworthy when he was a young man.
Yes.
And I thought that was really interesting that like he did that. And then a bunch of the stuff, the other things that they had to do. I can't remember if that was he did that and that corrected something or if they were correcting what he had caused there.
I'm not certain.
But I'm not sure there's an actual definitive answer of that.
Yes. And also what I find also very clever in that book is the character development of Eileen. At first, she looks like this young, naive student, hardworking and good-willing, but a bit, you know, kind of a kid compared to the other two. Polly and Mike are more experienced historians. They've been to time a couple times already. That's her first time travel. But yet, in the end, she's the one that stays behind. She's the one that stays in the period to take care of Alpha Bini. She adopts them. And it's implied that she's going to end up with the, what's his name? The priest. The vicar. Vicar Good, I think is his name. Something like that.
I don't even remember what his name was.
With the vicar, and that she's going to raise them, which is what happens. And it's I find very sweet and, you know, bittersweet that she stays behind and she saves them. Because they finally understand it's all part of the way history works and they're part of the mechanism.
And you know, from that perspective, you know, if she does end up being a progenitor of Colin, that's a whole other ball of wax.
Yeah,
but he wouldn't have existed without time travel.
There you go. And
John Connor.
Exactly. John Connor, yeah. And it's, but there, to me, the part where it's very implied that she's her grandmother or great-grandmother is when she says something to the effect of, always be with you, my dear boy. She says something that just before they part at the when they go back to Oxford, she says something like this, and the way it's set up, she knows. We don't know how, but she knows. I think Polly says that because his age, the last time she saw him, he was like 16 or 18 years old, and now he's more like 25 or something. And she looks at him and she's like, he looks a bit like Eileen. She says something to that effect too. And you go, oh, okay. And as you said, like it's back and forth and back and forth and it works together. And in a way that your brain has to roll a bit to figure out.
Yeah. And like I said about the, you know, it is definitely a long book, and I can understand if someone got frustrated with the length of it or got frustrated at, oh, okay, now they're passing like ships in the night again, you know, going one place where the other person is not going to be there. They're going, trying to look for them. And you could abridge that kind of thing, but I think it would take you out of the kind of mental focus of what it felt like to be those characters. Yes. And that's, you know, Connie Willis books, the ones that I've read, you know, the plots are great, but it's really the way she draws the characters that draws you into the story.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. She has a very deep understanding, I would say, of human nature, its strengths and weaknesses, and it's never on the nose or boring. So, I mean, in the hand of another writer, the same length of writing on the same subject could be dull as, you know, completely boring, and you wouldn't, you know, after 200 pages, okay, thank you, bye. She pulls that off, which is, you know, I understand the criticism, as I said, you know, at the beginning of the episode, but, and I do share some of it. There are like few parts where, okay, she could have skipped that chapter or make it shorter or whatever, but it's not that detrimenting to the book. It's not that bad, you know, it's, and the rest is so great that, you know, who cares? Let yourself go with the story and let it flow.
Yeah. It's funny because, you know, I had an easier time getting through this one. Not that I read it all in print, because I've confessed that I used the audiobook to fill in. But when I would sit down and read, I would make progress at a rate much greater than I made on like a book, a really short book like The Big Time. Was one that I did a few months ago. I just had a hard time with that one. And this, just, there's something about Connie Willis's prose that just flows. And it's just easy to get sucked into it and just sit there reading for an hour and make really good progress. And I always enjoy that.
Yeah, the length of a book has nothing to do with how long it takes you to read it. I recall at the beginning of the year, I'd won a book called Axiom's End. And I don't recall the name of the author. What's her name? Anyway, she's famous because she's a film critic anyway. And I won the book on a Goodreads giveaway. And okay, you know, great. And apparently she's a bit famous, whatever. The book is maybe 220 pages long. Took me forever to go through. I did it out of intellectual, you know, honesty, because I won it, and you know, the idea is that you win it, you have to write a review. So, and I don't write a review of a book if I don't read it. And you know, but it took me forever to read those 220 pages or something because I found it quite dull. Anyway, so, but this, I mean, took me some time because you need the physical time to actually go through it. But
yeah,
it was not hard to sit, as you said, for an hour or two and just, you know, enjoy the story. And also she chops everything into chapters that are not very long. So it's very for you to read, stop, start again. You know, you're not lost in time, if I may say.
The tricky part, I mean, and this is, right, authors do this on purpose, right? Where you've got Polly as a point of view character with a short chapter that ends on a little bit of a cliffhanger, and now you're with Mike for a chapter, and then with Eileen for a chapter before you can finally get back to find out what happened to Polly.
She does this a lot.
That can be frustrating.
Yeah.
Especially, you know, as they're starting to sync up. The stories are starting to sync up. And you're like, okay, they're going to find her in this building that's about to be bombed.
Yeah.
And that was very exciting.
Yes.
When they finally call
that, like they go up the elevator, she goes down the stairs, something like that, you know, and they finally have to meet up. And I like the fact that, you know, when we said that Polly knows when the bombings are going to happen, I like the fact that Willis was aware that that knowledge is not precise because sometimes, you know, the records are not perfect, for one, and sometimes our knowledge comes from newspapers, but sometimes a newspaper voluntarily put the wrong information in the paper because they wanted the Germans to read that because the Germans were bombing at night. And so if they know, okay, we send the planes to these coordinates, roughly, we bomb this, they could correct, because course correct for the next bombing. So if you give them false information that you bomb this area instead of this one, then next time they come, maybe they bomb the Thames.
Right. Yeah. And that was when they were doing the rocket attacks, right? Because there was...
rocket and also the bombings, because the bombings were happening at night for the second part of the Blitz. So they don't know exactly where they're bombing. They have to... They had some sort of radio system. The Germans don't have radar definitely not GPS, of course. So they have to use radio beams to figure out, triangulate their position. And the British were using anti-beams, it's called the War of the Beams, it's quite funny, to try to block that system. So the Germans were not always sure where they were bombing. So they had to check with spies and newspaper where the bomb actually fell. And so the British had to give them some false and real information. You know, it's the whole intelligence game, which is very fascinating to study during World War II on both sides.
Yeah. Well, and you have Mike kind of mixing between being deceptive about where the bombs landed or the rockets landed, and also trying to put out messages back to Oxford in the future that they would understand.
Yes. And he does that a lot when he's part of the British Army in 1944. It takes quite a long time to figure out that this character is actually Mike. I think you don't discover that until the first third of All Clear or something like that.
Yeah. He was the other kind of, you had a couple things with him with the inflatable tanks and the bull early in I keep wanting to say Doomsday Book, early in Blackout.
Yeah.
It comes back full circle.
Yes. And this part, along with the part where Eileen is with the two kids, are by far the funniest part of the book. I went through like so fast. It was so fun to read. And it did make me reconsider what a temperamental kid is, because these two are, especially Alf.
Yes.
Oh boy.
And the parrot that they trained to do the both the air raid and the all clear.
Yes. Yeah. But it's also tragic because you see where they come from, and the mother doesn't care at all for them, and you know, so you feel for them. You know, they're the two kids in an impossible situation, reacting like kids would.
That's what I started to pick up on, the fact that Eileen might not go back to the future because of the promises that she was making to Alf and Binny. And I thought, there's no way she can break these promises.
Yeah, it's either she stays or she brings them back. So,
I guess that would have been the other way to do it, right? If they were going to be killed off or something.
Exactly.
It would be, you know, similar thing to the cat coming through, and to say nothing of the dog. Because the cat disappearing helped the plot move forward.
Yes.
I like this quote. It's really toward the end of the book. No one person or thing won the war. People argue over whether it was Ultra or the evacuation from Dunkirk or Churchill's leadership or fooling Hitler into thinking we were invading at Calais that won the war. But it wasn't any one of them. It was all of them and 1,000, a million other things and people, and not just soldiers and pilots and Wrens, but air raid wardens and plane spotters and debutantes and mathematicians and weekend sailors and vicars.
I recall that.
It's you know, a love letter to the British people who lived through that time.
That's true. And it's very accurate. I mean, you can't say World War II was won up because of this. It's impossible. You know, there are a million elements to take into consideration. It's probably, I do think, it's the most studied part of human history, because one, it's the biggest conflict that ever happened. And also it's quite recent, you know. My grandfather's fought the war. It's not that distant. One of them was a prisoner for 2 years in Germany, close to Nuremberg. And he came back to France in 1942 and early 1943. Here comes my dad. So it's really not far from us when you think about it. If I may, before we go on, you know, final thought on this whole thing. One thing I do like to say about World War II and especially the ideologies that were, you know, shown during that war and before the war. I recall when I was studying history, I gave some classes to first-year students and stuff. And I was trying to tell them what happened in Germany or Italy at the time with fascism and Nazism is not a German or Italian problem. It's a universal problem. What happened to them could happen to anyone. We're not superior or better than they were. We're not better-minded or lovely or whatever. What happened to Germany, what it became, was because of circumstances and the way people acted upon these circumstances. And, you know, I don't want to get into politics, but what happens in our world these days reminds me a bit of that. What happened in the States in the last 4 years, what happened here in Canada in the last election, what is happening now in France, if you follow, they're going to have a presidential election next year. And one of the potential candidates, it's not declared yet, but it has very high support in France, has, for example, an idea that everybody in France should have a French Christian first name. So if you're from, I don't know, Asian or African or whatever origin, and your name, Mai or Mohammed or whatever, you should change it to Michel, Paul, you know. That gives you an idea of, you know, we're not that far from camps in my mind when I hear that kind of stuff. So it's very important to educate people about these events and these historical issues, because we're not done with them, and they are not linked to a particular people. These are human issues. These are issues that affect all societies throughout time. And, you know, last time we let that happen, we had World War II. You know, so I don't want to be gloom, you know, I don't want to to sound like, you know.
No, it's important.
But it is important, I think, to see it, to acknowledge it, that, you know. And to me, the only defense, I guess, that is education, proper education, reading everything, even things that don't make you comfortable. I mean, reading about the Holocaust doesn't make me comfortable, but it helps me. I understand why it happened and why and how it could be prevented from happening again, because it could.
Yeah. Okay. Final thoughts on this one. I really enjoyed it. I think I did prefer both of the other two entries in the Oxford Time Travel more than this, but it's close, and this one will be high up on my rankings.
Yeah, I have the same feeling as you do. Very, very good books, definitely worthy of the Hugo Award it won, and just interesting read, even for people that are not that much into sci-fi, because it's just an interesting journey into a big human endeavor and adventure.
Yeah, I was telling my wife that, you know, she's not much of a science fiction fan, and I said these books are ones that I think you would enjoy, because they they focus more on the characters and the story and the drama, and different people like different things. And I'm sure there are people who prefer books like, you know, Blue Mars, who might not like a book like this.
Yes.
Because it's wordy and it's about the characters more than the nuts and bolts. And, you know, it's fine. We've got all kinds of science fiction.
Yes, which is great.
You have to like everything. Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, Emmanuel, thank you so much for choosing this title and being patient with me while I figured out when I was going to be able to fit it in. Because I told you, I'm just going to let this one slide until I see that see a slot that I think I can fit it into, so that I'll have time to read both those books. So thank you so much for that. I appreciate it.
You're very welcome. That's perfectly fine. Merci beaucoup, Seth.
All right. And where can people find you?
So two ways. As a photographer, you can find me on manuphoto.com. So manuphoto.com. That's my photo website. And as a camera store manager, I'm at Camtech Photo, like a boutique. So a bit of a high-end store in Montreal. We're in all Montreal. actually. So if you want to visit the old town, the old French town, that's where we are. And you'll be welcome in French, English, or even German if you come down to the store. I speak some German too.
Sounds good.
There you go. So, yeah, if you ever come down or actually come up to Canada, please drop by.
I definitely will if we get up that way. My wife really wants to go see Quebec, so that would be neat. And I've never been to the East Coast of the United States, so I could do that all in one trip.
You're from Alaska, right?
I'm originally from Alaska, and we live in Oregon now.
Okay, so you made that third of the way, so you can.
Yeah. All right, well, it was great talking to you again. I love that you brought your scholarship here to talk about World War II. Really, really great conversation. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right, bye. The theme music for the Hugo's There podcast was composed and performed by Tim Cuskey.